Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 8, prayers by Queen Kunti, text 28. Translation. My lord, I consider your lordship. My lord, I consider your lordship to be eternal time, the supreme controller, without beginning and end, the all-pervasive one. In distributing your mercy, you are equal to everyone. The dissensions between living beings are due to social intercourse. Purport. Kunti Devi knew that Krishna was neither her nephew nor an ordinary family member of her paternal house. She knew perfectly well that Krishna is the primeval Lord who lives in everyone's heart as the Supersoul, Paramatma. Another name of the Paramatma feature of the Lord is Kala, or eternal time. Eternal time is the witness of all our actions, good and bad, and thus resultant reactions are destined by him. It is no use saying that we do not know why and for what we are suffering. We may forget the misdeed for which we may suffer at this present moment, but we must remember that Paramatma is our constant companion, and therefore he knows everything, past, present, and future. And because the Paramatma feature of Lord Krishna destines all actions and reactions, he is a supreme controller also. Without his sanction, not a blade of grass can move. The living beings are given as much freedom as they deserve, and misuse of that freedom is the cause of suffering. The devotees of the Lord do not misuse their freedom, and therefore they are the good sons of the Lord. Others who misuse freedom are put into miseries destined by the eternal Kala. The Kala offers the conditioned souls both happiness and miseries. It is all predestined by eternal time. As we have miseries uncalled for, so we may have happiness also, without being asked, for they are all predestined by Kala. No one is there for either an enemy or friend of the Lord. Everyone is suffering and enjoying the result of his own destiny. This destiny is made by the living beings in course of social intercourse. Everyone here wants to lord it over the material nature, and thus everyone creates his own destiny under the supervision of the Supreme Lord. He is all-pervading, and therefore he can see everyone's activities. And because the Lord has no beginning or end, he is known also as the eternal time, Kala. Om Yenatimanandasya Yenanjana Shalakaya Chakshunalitam Yena Tasmai Sri Guru.
Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivastani Guru Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
To understand our life, we spoke yesterday about having to understand our context. How, in our foolish, utterly distorted approach to life, we cut our existence out of its natural context. We chop off the past, and we chop off the future, and we, to varying degrees, live in the moment. One person lives in terms of tomorrow. Another person lives in terms of the weekend. Another person may have a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. But from the viewpoint of Srimad Bhagavatam, that's still living in the moment, as long as you don't take into account your past lives and the reactions accrued from them, and your future life, which will be a reaction to your present life. Now you might say, this is quite a big vision to have. Isn't it just easy just to, you know, let the good times roll, go with the flow, and feel the moment? Isn't it enough to have a 3-year plan for when you finish the university? Isn't that enough? Why do we have to feel this burden? It may seem. Of always considering the mentality we had in the past, the reactions that we generated in our past lives, and what kind of body we'll have next. Why do we have to think about that? Isn't it so much easier just to merge into passion and ignorance? Just get into the body and get into the mind. Indulge, seek your satisfaction and fulfillment in that way. Isn't that so much easier? What do you think? By doing so, however, we lose our consciousness of our eternal spiritual identity. We're already suffering in the bodily conception of life. Why do we want to make it worse? That's the question everyone has to ask themselves. If you understand where your problems are coming from, if you truly understand where your miseries and distress are coming from, why would you want to do something that will increase the problem? If you do so, it means you don't understand. And in spite of hearing so many purports where the same point is brought up again and again, we don't understand, we don't accept. We were discussing during our evening reading a few days ago, why is it that Prabhupada's purports seem to repeat certain points over and over again? Sometimes devotees who think they've been around long enough, they say, well, Prabhupada's books are nice, but they repeat a lot. They repeat a lot of basic information. So, ask any teacher in an ordinary school, ask any parent of little children, if you repeat something, a basic point, again and again, what does that mean? Right, they're not picking it up. They're not getting the point, although it's repeated so many times. So we should have a humble attitude in approaching Srila Prabhupada's books. Repetition of basic points is there because basically we have missed the point. We just push it away. No, it can't be like that. You can watch yourself doing this. Watch your consciousness rebel. No, I don't want to hear it. You do that in a respectful way, of course. So the repetition of basic points is there because people aren't so bright these days. But we may be very proud of ourselves. We're not very proud, but a little bit of pride is good, right? I've heard this before, the modes of nature. Everyone is controlled, misuse of independence. Come on, let's move on to something higher. Well, there are higher things in Prabhupada's books, but you won't see them effectively until you master the basic points. Srila Prabhupada's books, as we've explained, they're like a perfect one-room schoolhouse. I don't know if any of you have gone to a one-room schoolhouse where there are more than one grade in one room. Anyone? Yes. So it takes a very expert teacher to run a one-room schoolhouse. I went to a school for my first 3 years that had 4 grades in one room, a total of 30 students. And the teacher was so expert, she could keep all those 4 grades motivated. So that's an example to show you the brilliance of Srila Prabhupada's books. He is teaching everyone through his purports. He's teaching the most neophyte, newcomer. He's teaching someone who's known nothing about Krishna before. And he's also teaching a Mahabhagavat with his purports. He explained his books in that way. He said, there are points and information, instructions there for every level of devotee. And you'll see in his books what's relevant for your situation at your particular level of advancement. And it's amazing, as your Krishna consciousness develops, you start seeing things that you didn't see before. Things start to click with you that didn't click before. So that is the characteristic of a most expert teacher. You can teach all persons at the same time without overdosing someone or without underdosing someone. That's the best kind of doctor. So let us consider, what is our main enemy at this present stage of existence in the material world? Our main enemy is absorption in the body and mind. The body is full of various secretions, the mind is full of various emotions and plans. So material life means absorb yourself in basically secretions, emotions, and plans. That's all that's going on. There's no mystery about it. So, if you want to be in the bodily conception of life, what is your daily program? You have to decide, okay, how will the secretions go today? And how will the emotions be today? And what plans do we have for today? That's all what's going on. But we dress it up in so many complicated ways. Technological wrappings, financial wrappings, political wrappings. But it's the same old three things: secretions, emotions, and plans. And of course, the plans are for how to emit secretions and emotions in a more fulfilling way. That's the purpose of plans. So if you can see all this clearly, you'll save yourself so much unnecessary suffering. Why suffering? Well, doesn't the bodily immersion and the emotional immersion, doesn't it give you some satisfaction? But because that kind of immersion involves forgetfulness of your spiritual identity, that's the greatest suffering. How can we dare think that we can generate pleasure separate from Krishna? This is a great mystery. How can we have that idea? On my own, I'll be a pleasure factory. On my own, I'll squeeze out some nectar drops from material existence. I've got that power. I've got that ability. If we truly understand our tiny constitutional position, we know without connection to Krishna, that is yoga, connection to Krishna. Without that, what can I do? Therefore, we're always crying out to Krishna for connection. And as we spoke yesterday, the prayer by Queen Kunti, she says, if material circumstances reduce the feeling by which you call out to Krishna, that's a great setback. Our goal is to increase the quality of the feeling in our crying out to Krishna. Yes, they are. Esteemed guest Ayodhadev Prabhu, he encouraged us very nicely. He pointed out to me that during the kirtan, I noticed the devotees are really calling out to Krishna. And he also mentioned that I noticed during japa, they're chanting with very good attention. So I felt very encouraged by that observation. Although, of course, I told him, well, I don't know if it's like that all the time, every hour of the day. But it's a good symptom, though, to note. It's a good indicator that something is going on, all right? Calling out to Krishna with feeling. How else can you exist? Call out for bodily satisfaction with feeling. It's animalistic. Call out for emotional satisfaction, material emotional satisfaction. You'll go crazy that way. Try it. You don't believe me? Try it. You'll be on an emotional roller coaster all your life and never get what you want. call out to Krishna. That is real emotion. Bhakti is completely emotional, but it's the perfection of emotional science. When our emotions are connected to Krishna's service, then we are for real. Otherwise, how can you be genuine with anyone? How can you look someone in the eye and say, I'm for real? When you're living a life cut off from Krishna and you're absorbing yourself in your temporary body and temporary mind. So then you approach other persons, considering them separate from Krishna. You're separate from Krishna, they're separate from Krishna. So you approach someone. Let's make exchanges of secretions, emotions, and plans. I have some secretions, you have some secretions. I have some emotions, you have some emotions. I'll make plans, you'll make plans. That's life. That's all that's going on. You look a bit stunned. You really think there's something else going on? It's just the exchange of secretions, emotions, and plans. That's all. But in order to pursue that agenda, we make so many complications and packagings, intricacies, plans and counterplans and backup plans. On and on it goes. And therefore, on and on material existence goes, body after body. Queen Kunti Devi is pointing out the role of time. She says, actually, Manye Twam Kalamishanam, Krishna, I consider that you are time. Why? Because time is the supreme controller. Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Kalosmi, I am time. He explains to Arjuna, even if you choose not to fight in this battle, even if you choose not to do my will, still, time will move on and accomplish its goals. And in fact, I am time. So everyone recognizes the supreme authority. Why? Because everyone submits to time. Just observe during the day how time is controlling you. Everything you do, your wants, your needs, materially speaking, are all saturated with time. Look at the person so dear to you. Study their body, study their mind. It's composed of time, ruled by time. Look at your goals. Look at the paraphernalia surrounding you and your life. You'll see they're all ruled by time. Then you should get the point. You're imprisoned. How can you think you're free? Your hobbies, your entertainment, your delights, your joys, your sorrows are all bound by time. So any intelligent person can see that you are not in control. You're totally dependent. Now, how do you escape from thinking in this way? You have to do what is so popular these days in material existence. You have to become intoxicated to some degree. You don't want to have anxiety from noticing time. So therefore, intoxication is a necessity in today's civilization. We've explained so many times. If you just took away all forms of intoxication in New Zealand, every form, alcohol, synthetic drugs, marijuana, caffeine. People would go crazy. They couldn't face life. In other words, they need to forget. They need to take their eye off the road as they're driving. And they need to take their hands off the steering wheel. And that's what intoxication does. I don't see time anywhere. Do you see time? I feel good. And similarly, that is the role of bodily indulgence. So-called pleasure from bodily indulgence is simply you forget about time. You get so much into the flesh that you don't have to think of anything else. Your mind just boils. And you create, you think you're creating your own little world of physical and emotional indulgence where time can't touch you. You want to forget about time. But our four rules are there to protect you from forgetting about time. Each one of the regular principles ensures that you'll be able to see time. Most of you don't know anything about gambling. You know about the other things, but you don't know about gambling. I've heard from persons who are big-time gamblers who walk into a casino with no less than $100,000 in cash on them. And it's a total consciousness. It's a total absorption. So, we want to avoid anything that causes us to forget Krishna. And forgetting time means forgetting Krishna. We want to see the reality. We want to see how we're shackled, how we're bound up. Then we can actually enthusiastically pursue the process for becoming free. Kunti Devi, the most liberated woman, is advising us how to see Krishna by seeing time. There's a verse in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam which says that an intelligent person looks at the whole universe and sees it in the jaws of the snake of time. That's how you see the world around you. Krishna says, Kalosmi, I am time. Seeing time means you're seeing Krishna. How can you say you never saw God? If you can see time, you are seeing the Supreme. Kunti Devi is pointing that out. Manye Twam Kalamishanam. I consider your lordship the eternal time. Anadi Nidanam Gahum. Time has no beginning or end. It's all pervasive. She said, this is you. You're not simply my nephew. You are eternal time. Time is the impersonal manifestation of Krishna. So we want to see time. We want to see Krishna. Even though, as long as you're engaged in hearing about Krishna, chanting Krishna's name in kirtan and japa, you're actually immune from time. You're in a bubble. It doesn't mean your body won't deteriorate, but it means your consciousness is free from time. And that's a minimum part of the nectar you're tasting in kirtan. You feel time suspended. That's the minimum, bare minimum. Kirtan is much more than simply associating with Krishna's impersonal manifestation of time. Kirtan is the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his potencies. So let's again consider the prime lures, the prime traps of Kali Yuga, passion and ignorance. That means various methods of bodily and mental indulgence. Those indulgences put you firmly in the grip of time. You can't even see what's going on. You're totally encased in the darkness of unconditional surrender to time. By such absorption, how can we think of Krishna? By such absorption, we're simply increasing the problems because we are increasing bodily identification. We have to drill this into our head. Why am I suffering? Is it because I had bad plans or I had bad karma? Why am I suffering? The root cause of suffering is identification with the body and mind as the self. That means forgetfulness of Krishna. So why should I do something that will increase my problems? You have to ask yourself that question. Once you know where your problems come from, why do something that puts you back into the fire again? You have to see scientifically. This is real intelligence. It doesn't refer to whether you have an academic degree or not. Do you know the source of your problems? Truly. It's the same thing Krishna points out to Arjuna in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita. Asochan Amasochastram Pragya Bottoms Japasasa. Arjuna, you are lamenting for what is not worthy of lamentation. You think you're the body, and you think other persons are the body. That is the root cause of your problem. So this is why Bhakti Yoga practitioners are very careful with their behavior. They're careful about how they sleep, what they eat, how they mate, and how they defend. They're very careful about that, because they don't want to increase the problems. The problems are due to bodily absorption, identification with the body as the self. We've done it in the past. It's got us into such crazy consciousness. Why do we want to increase our misery? We want to become free. That means engaging in Krishna's service. The more that we relish any chance to serve Krishna, the smarter we are. A Bhakti Yoga practitioner is in love with the miracle of devotional service. Give me any service, Krishna. Whether it's to my propensity or not, I'll be so happy to have service to you. If you can serve Krishna according to your material propensity, that's nice. But in the higher stages of bhakti, that's not a prerequisite. For neophytes, yes, it makes things more comfortable. I have this skill. I can play music, so I'll play music for Krishna. I can manage, so I'll manage for Krishna. But actually, full bhakti, which is our goal, is let me do whatever Krishna wants, however Krishna wants it, whenever Krishna wants. That's real love. You would want that for yourself. You would want to be served by someone who says, whatever you want, however you want it, whenever you want it. And you would love that. How would you like if someone was serving you and they said, well, you know, I've got my propensity, and so here's what I can do. wait a minute. You'd be like those persons in that university experiment we talked about yesterday. Turn up the electric shock. I want full surrender. But when we come to Krishna, we get very coy, very dodgy. Well, Krishna, you know, I can only really do this, you know. After all, it's my propensity, and you should be glad that I'm at least trying to serve you with my propensity. Don't expect anything more. Be glad you're getting at least that. But it's true that in the beginning of devotional service, even in the middle stages, we try to facilitate devotees serving Krishna according to propensity. But we shouldn't think it is absolutely required and absolutely necessary. It isn't. It's a concession. Varnashram Dharma is a concession. It's Krishna's concession. Varnashram Dharma, the four occupational divisions according to propensities, the four social orders according to propensities, that's a material system. But it's Krishna's material system for living in the material world. So, the point is, whether we have a chance to serve Krishna with our propensities or not, we are so greedy for any chance to serve Krishna. That's bhakti. We're eternally grateful for any opportunity to serve Krishna. We don't stick up our noses at any service. We know that's what I need. I've got to have it. Just like a person in the bodily conception of life is convinced, I've got to have sensuality. A bhakti yoga practitioner is convinced, I've got to have devotional service. No devotional service is demeaning. Of course, gradually, you learn the art of how to discern what is the best service for Krishna you should be doing at a particular moment. Just like Mother Yashoda, she was feeding Krishna. First she was churning butter, and then Krishna, who had been sleeping in another room — Krishna doesn't need rest, but he sleeps just as a pastime. You don't need rest, but he rests. Just for his own satisfaction. Let me taste the pleasure of resting, even though I'm not tired. You can't conceive what that's like. And it gives his mother pleasure, too, to know her little boy is resting. And Krishna knows that. And he's stimulating the vatsalya praying, the love of Krishna and parenthood. I'll rest for mother. She thinks unless I rest, I'll be weak and I'll be tired. Okay, I'll rest. I'll enjoy the pastime of resting, even though I'm never tired, never exhausted. And she'll get to feel that I'm a good boy who's so dependent on her. He got up, though, because he decided it's time for another pastime. I'm hungry, even though I'm always self-sufficient and own-porn, I'm perfect and complete. I want to taste the nectar of being hungry. And in that nectar tasting of being hungry, that means I taste my mother's breast milk to give her that parental feeling, pure love of Krishna. So Mother Yashoda, she's churning away. And then Krishna approaches her and grabs the churning rod. So Mother Yashoda was so impressed. Oh, see how intelligent my little boy is. He's stopping me from churning yogurt into butter because he wants to be fed. So she stopped her churning and she sat down and put Krishna on her lap and began to feed him. And as she's feeding him, she's looking into his infinitely beautiful face. What an intimate scene. Because some devotees want to love Krishna as Krishna's parent. So Krishna gives them that opportunity, even though he has no mother or father. He doesn't need any mother or father. He's the source of everything. But being the source of everything means he's the source of the greatest pleasure. And so he wants to give devotees who desire to love him as his parent, he wants to give them that opportunity. So he did with Mother Yashoda. While she's feeding him, she's staring into his beautiful face, studying that infinitely beautiful face. Then she notices milk on the stove is boiling over. Why is that milk on the stove? Mother Yashoda is personally making some milk goodies for Krishna because she's so concerned. Why is he breaking into other people's houses stealing butter? And what's wrong with the milk products in my home? So she took special milk from very special cows in her herd. And she herself, rather than entrusting the task to the maidservants, she herself was preparing these milk products for Krishna to stop the butter thief. So the milk was over boiling. What did she do? She put Krishna down, and then she went to the stove to fix the milk that was boiling over. Now, she put Krishna down. Was she neglecting Krishna? Did she make a mistake? No. Everything in her house is meant for Krishna's pleasure, 100%. There's nothing indirect in Mother Yashoda's house in terms of Krishna's pleasure. Everything is 100% directly for the pleasure of Yashoda Nandana. But Krishna decided, for this leela, for this pastime, she has made a mistake. That's part of the leela, even though she had made no mistake. And so, in response to this mistake that my mother has done, by putting me down and tending to just some milk boiling over on the stove, big deal, milk boils over the stove, who cares? I was on my mother's lap. I was being fed. She was looking in my face. Now she put me down. Therefore, time for mischief. Before he embarked on his mischief mission, Krishna demonstrated the unlimited ananda of being angry. Even bit his lip. She put me down. She neglected me. And then he went on his mission of smashing the butter pot and letting the contents, the freshly churned yogurt, not quite butter yet, let it flow all over the floor. And that's how he began his Damodara Leela. So, Mother Yashoda knew exactly what to do. In serving Krishna, I do this, then I do that. She made no mistake. Krishna gives the advanced devotee all intelligence what to do next for his service. So as we become more mature bhakti yogis, we get that intelligence from Krishna. What to do, in what sequence for his pleasure. The more we relish service opportunities, the more Krishna feels motivated to give us the intelligence how to serve him. And you have to know how to turn down service opportunities with the right attitude. Never stick up your nose at any service offer. Never look down upon it. I'm not doing that. What do you think I am? Krishna's servant. You have to know how to politely and very respectfully say, well, because I'm doing this service, I can't do that service. Everyone has to learn how to do that according to their ashram. Different ashrams have different styles. And so, you know your goal is to be always engaged in Krishna's service. But in various ashrams, you have various types of secondary things you have to do. Sometimes it's said, well, how do we know how to balance? How do we know how to balance our spiritual activities with our material necessities? First of all, you have to recognize what is on the scales. What are you trying to balance? You have to see clearly the components of your life, the devotional activities, the material necessities. If those material necessities, those material tasks, are indeed truly supportive and contributing to your bhakti lifestyle, they're not just ordinary material tasks, but secondary. You could even say they're like secondary devotional activities. But without the primary devotional activities of the 9 processes of devotional service, all based on Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, hearing and chanting about Krishna, the secondary aspects of your life will be futile, and in fact, they'll overtake you as the primary. Let's get into bodybuilding. Let's get into raw foods. Let's get into this hobby or that hobby. The secondary overtakes the primary. Whereas in a proper perspective, the primary activities of bhakti are actually helped by the secondary activities. You have to take care of your health so that you can properly execute devotional activities while in this body. You have to eat properly. You have to know how to eat properly so that you can serve Krishna effectively. So there's harmony when you understand what is primary. But if you lose sight of what is primary, how are you going to balance? If you lose your perspective, you can't balance. So again, we need to know what goes on each side of the scale. It's the primary and the secondary. It's not like Maya's on the other side of the scale. Well, I need some Maya in my life just to balance things out, you know? A little bit of Maya keeps the system flowing smoothly, you know? The scales are not that on one side is devotional service and the other side is Maya. Often I hear it like that. No, the scales mean on one side are your primary devotional activities, 9 processes of bhakti. On the other side are secondary backup activities meant to assist your service, taking care of your health, eating properly, so on and so forth. Cleaning. A balanced life is very important, and Krishna himself comes to teach the balance. He says in Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata. Whenever there's dharmasya glani, there's an imbalance in human affairs, I come. In other words, whenever human beings don't know how to handle life, Krishna says he comes. He comes himself. He comes as Bhagavad Gita. He comes as his devotees, just to rectify the human situation. Now, nowhere is Krishna referring to the balance as having devotional activities on one side and material indulgence on the other side. That's not the balance. We kind of concoct that. Well, you know, devotees should be balanced. They should have balanced lives, you know, some spiritual activities and some, you know, material enjoyment. No. Material enjoyment simply leads to more body identification, which sets you up to be more of a prisoner of time. It's the last thing you want. So you have to have like a sixth sense that tells you, this, what I'm thinking of doing, is going to increase my imprisonment. I'm already in trouble thinking on the body. Why do I want to increase that problem? The more you get into the habit of asking yourself that question, the more sane you will be. Otherwise, we are all deemed to be crazy as long as we can't see how we are increasing our suffering by increasing our bodily absorption. And what is bodily absorption all about again? Remember, secretions, emotions, plans, it's all that's going on. As simple as that. Kunti Devi here says, Bhutanam yan mitat kali. The dissensions between living beings are due to social intercourse. It means that you can't blame Krishna for your problems. You're generating your own problems in your interactions with others. It's your thing. It's a social thing. Kunti's saying, don't blame Krishna. It's the way human beings interact under the influence of time and the modes of material nature. Krishna simply fulfills the appropriate reactions to their actions. But you can't blame Krishna. He's just giving the just results. He, meaning his system, gives the just desserts. That's all. You generated your own happiness and distress. So Krishna's material nature is the perfect machine that responds to what you generated. See, don't blame Krishna. We've spoken before how time brings you your happiness and distress. It's served up to you by time. At the right time, you get a happy feeling due to your karma. At the right time, you get a distress feeling due to your karma. They all show up uninvited. So just like your distress is uninvited, still it shows up at your door. Similarly, happiness, material happiness, is uninvited. It shows up at your door. But why do we condemn the so-called progress of today? Because it's all about imagining how you yourself can generate more happiness, and you can't. You can't generate more material happiness than what you're due by time. You're just wasting your energy. You can grab as many bodies and minds as you like and squeeze them till they all turn blue. But you won't get more happiness than what you're supposed to get. So save yourself some trouble and understand that. As hard as you work, as hard as you party and try to enjoy, you're just going to get what you're supposed to get. Now, you might have had an inkling of this in your material days, but why couldn't you fully assimilate the point? Because you look around and Maya makes it seem that everyone else is enjoying except you. You maybe think about it. You might remember yourself noting, I'm just not really happy doing these things. It just wasn't like I heard it was supposed to be. Then you look around. Oh, they're all enjoying. They're all getting happiness. So I must be faulty. I must be doing something wrong. Let me associate with more expert sense gratifiers. Get some tips. This is an hallucination produced by Maya. Actually, everyone is feeling emptiness and feeling a lack in their happiness department. But it's just part of the way the illusion works. You don't go around telling people that. So there's this appearance that everyone else is okay, more or less. It's just me and my issues and my traumas and my inabilities. I'll keep trying. I'll keep adjusting the material energy, making changes. I'll get there. Can't give up. That's what friends in society are for, to make sure you don't give up. Keep your nose pressed to the grindstone. Others are enjoying. You'll enjoy too. Keep your nose pressed to the grindstone. Don't lift your nose away, whatever you do. And never reach your Mibhagata. Okay, you want to read it, you can, but don't take it so seriously. Srimad Bhagavatam is for keeping on the shelf of the bookshelf in your room. It's the presence of Narayan. Okay, Maya grants you that concession. Bhagavatam in your house means Krishna is there. Don't read it. Don't deprogram yourself. So try to understand how much conformists we actually are. Individuals pride themselves these days on, you know, I'm my own person, you know. I have my own life and my own desires and my own way of achieving my desires and my own fashions, my own styles. In a consumer society, manufacturers appeal to that. You know, they'll offer you 10 different colors for an iPhone cover. Which color is you? Everything these days, you know, is a world of colors, and you can choose the color that matches. And in fact, they even make phone coverings of different colors, and you can switch the phone covering to match your mood on that day. Gonna match your outfit. This is the perfection of individual expression. To see what society is doing for you. Everything is designer this and designer that, custom this, custom that, this option, that option, all for you to express yourself. So what happens is that you not only look at consumer goods in that way, but you also look at other persons in that way. What option are you? Okay, you look okay for today. Lime green. Yeah, that's my mood. Okay, you're on for today. 2 days later, I'm in a different mood. What about you? Oh, coral colored. Yeah, that matches me. So you start treating people in that way. And you expect other human beings to respond toward you in this way. Why aren't you matching my mood today? This is the way, the mentality that a consumerist mind functions with. We're supposed to be in a relationship. Why aren't you matching my mood? Today I am in mango orange mood. Haven't you picked that up? What's the use of you? Forget you, time for another option. And everyone approves. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Switch around, shop around, change. You've got to be you. So people become consumer goods. And that's the kind of pressure you put on others in your relationships. Don't you know my mood? Today it's turquoise. Why aren't you responding? What's the use of you? It's crazy. A real choice is choosing Krishna's service. And so we always worship any opportunity to engage in Krishna's service. We don't psych ourselves out of devotional service. It's a very easy thing to do under the influence of the material energy. Oh, I had this argument with a devotee, therefore I won't engage in devotional service anymore. There was this problem. The last time I tried to serve Krishna, there were some promises that there would be this facility and that facility, and there was a problem with those promises being fulfilled, so you know what that means. No more service out of me. The logical conclusion, right? Well, there's problems in the air in terms of pollution. Would you stop breathing? No more breathing for me. Sometimes, you know, whoever's cooking may make a mistake and something's burnt or something, you know, they put salt in instead of sugar or something like that. Do you say, oh, that's it for me, no more eating. I'll never eat again. Even we see, and unfortunate situations, there are extreme problems generated in marriage, and so, all right, that relationship was problematic. Who says, that's it for me, never again in this life? We don't see that happening. You immediately re-enlist. So why then do we get so super holy with ourselves about, I've been wronged in devotional service. No more service. This is how we cheat. If we truly understood the miracle of devotional service, in spite of whatever inconveniences or impediments or upsets that we may have legitimately incurred, no doubt about it, still, we are desperate for service to Krishna. That is the perfection of greed. We never let anything psych us out of our greed for devotional service. Then we are living, otherwise we are dead, while still breathing. So this is the bhakti yogi in action. I long for service. All right, if you catch me at a moment when I don't have any service, I'm happy to do something. The only reason why I'll say no is because I'm doing some other service. Also, I have my secondary activities, which I have to do to support my service, whether it's earning money, cleaning the house, or something like that. But I always understand those things are secondary. You're able to see everything in proper perspective. In this way, you become free from time just by hearing about these things. We forgot all about time. Now, the way this world works is that complications and distresses come to everyone, even devotees, because they're living in the material world. You shouldn't have a romantic, naive conception about material existence, even as a devotee. When Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna declared boldly, Kauntiya Prachidanihi Name Bhakta Pradashuti. Declare boldly, Arjuna, my devotee is never vanquished. He's referring to your spiritual life. He's not referring to your material body or your material situation. Anything material must be vanquished. It's under the influence of time. But your bhakti and your real identity, that is never vanquished. So even for devotees, intricacies can be around them. They can be caught up, apparently, intricacies. That's the way of this world. So you have to know how to handle all that, how to keep the ship afloat amidst the various complications of Kali Yuga. Krishna himself shows that apparently even he has to deal with intricacies, as we heard yesterday in terms of the Shailantaka jewel. Krishna was defamed. This Shailantaka jewel was supposed to bring all good fortune. Wherever the jewel rested, there would be no pestilence, no untimely death, no extreme weather changes, no strange problems. But because Satyajit possessed that jewel with a material mentality and didn't even give it to Krishna when Krishna asked for it, that same Shailantaka jewel brought so much distress and misfortune. So here you see the downfall of material attachment clearly. I once heard Srila Prabhupada say, pick out any material attachment and understand what it will do to you. Sooner or later, it will kick you in the face. Ooh, severe. Oh. But try to see that. So the Shailantaka jewel literally kicked Satyajit in the face. It caused so many problems due to his material attachment. I can't give this jewel to Krishna. Krishna didn't want it. He wanted the jewel to be presented to Ugrasen, who's the king. That was proper. But Satyajit was so attached. So we discussed yesterday the first part of that Leela, and how finally when Krishna came back to Dwarka with Satyabhama and and the jewel, the residents of Dwarka were so relieved. Krishna has returned. Because while Krishna was gone, Krishna's devotees in Dwarka, they were spreading counter-rumors against Satyajit. It's because of Satyajit that Krishna has disappeared. So it was a whole rumor war. Evil-minded persons were saying that Krishna had taken the Shailantaka jewel, he had killed Satyajit's brother, and the devotees were saying, it's because of these rumors started by Satyajit that Krishna has disappeared, he's not with us anymore. So it was a whole controversy, which was solved when Krishna emerged with Jambavati and the jewel. And so there was a whole official assembly. King Ugrasena called the assembly, and in that official government assembly, Krishna said, here's the jewel, and he gave it back to Satyajit. And I thought, I don't need this. I just wanted to clear my name. But Satyajit, as we discussed at the end of yesterday's class, felt so mortified. Not really that he had offended, not because he had offended Krishna, but he was worried about his own skin. This is Dwarka. They're all mostly devotees. The Yadus, they're warriors. They can really pull me apart because I offended Krishna. I know I offended Krishna. These Yadus, they may tear me to pieces. I don't want that to happen. What to do? I know what to do. I'll give back the jewel to Krishna, and I'll give my daughter Satyabhama also. That'll look really good. That'll get the heat off my back. So he did that. He gave his beautiful daughter Satyabhama and the jewel to Krishna. But Krishna took the daughter Satyabhama and gave the jewel back again to Satyajit. You are a devotee of the sun god. You need these things. Krishna's being a bit sarcastic. You're not my devotee. You're a demigod worshiper. You're into this kind of stuff, Shyama Tucker jewels. Remember, even Jambavan didn't take the Shyama Tucker jewels so seriously. He gave it as a toy to his little boy. But a materialistically minded person, wow, a jewel that is so dazzling. People think, I'm Surya, the sun god, and this jewel, if you just do a little puja every day, you get mounds of gold every day. Wow, this is what life's all about. So Satyajit was into all that. So Krishna said, you take this jewel. I have the real treasure. I have Satyabhama. Of course, she's his eternal consort. The misfortune didn't end. Krishna and Balaram, they left Dwarka to go to Hastinapur because there were authorized informations that the Pandavas and Kunti Devi had died in a fire. Everyone was convinced that they were dead. And so Krishna went to their capital city, Hastinapur, Indraprastha, in order to grieve with relatives. Although Krishna and Balaram, being omniscient, knew they were alive, knew the Pandavas and Kunti were alive. But, you know, Krishna is just imitating the ways of general society. So, all right, everyone is convinced the Pandavas and Kunti are dead. Let me go grieve with my relatives. That's a part of society. Rejoicing together, grieving together, all right. So he and Balaram left, even though they knew the Pandavas were alive. So, as you may remember, the Pandavas escaped through a tunnel. And so they were alive and well, hiding. Krishna and Balaram in Hastinapur, they grieved with relatives. Externally, because they knew, but they just participated in the ways of human society. Not all the relatives were grieving, though. Duryodhana and company, they're dead. Our plot to burn them succeeded. So, meanwhile, what happened? While Krishna and Balaram were away from Dwarka, Akrura and Kritavarma, these are devotees of Krishna. They were motivated by anger. Satyajit, you've insulted the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We're going to fix you. So they went to Shatadanva, who's actually like an outlaw. You might say, well, what are outlaws doing in the vicinity of Dwarka? Well, this is all part of Krishna's Leela. You have outlaws in Dwarka, you've got prostitutes in Dwarka. So somehow they all contribute by their presence to Krishna's Leela. So Shatadanva was actually an evil-minded outlaw. And he had wanted to marry Satyabhama. because Satadri, as we explained yesterday, in his desire to please everyone, be popular, he had offered his beautiful daughter to everyone. She'll be yours. I promise her to you. She'll be your wife. She'll be yours. So that way he felt very popular, you know, like he's in control. Everyone wants my stunningly beautiful daughter. I just promise her to everyone. Everyone that way becomes beholden to me. So even the outlaw, the criminal, Shatadanva, he was promised such a bomb. And Akrura and Kritavarma knew that. So they, being clever devotees of the Lord, they knew how to manipulate Shatadanva's mind. They went to him and said, Sachaji has this jewel. You want the jewel, don't you? Such a priceless jewel, making gold. You want it, don't you? Not only that, but Sachaji, he promised his daughter to you, and instead he gave her to Krishna. What do you think about that? So then, in eloquent ways, they strongly suggested that Shatadanva kill Satyajit. How do they say that? Akrura said, don't you think that Satyajit should meet the same fate as his brother Prasena? Very skillful way of being part of a conspiracy, you know. Don't you think, instead of like, rub him out, don't you think he should meet the same destiny as his brother? So, it didn't take much to rile up Shatadanva. He was greedy, he was evil-minded. Yeah, I get the jewel, I get revenge because I didn't get such a bomber. So, you may ask the question, why is it that Akrura and Kritavarma, both great devotees of Krishna, what are they doing, participating in a murder conspiracy? Well, they were, as I said, so angry at Satyadri because of his spreading rumors against Krishna. So therefore, they decided to take action. And so, they were so effective in their presentation, Shatadanva, who's already a crooked mentality, and already hated Satyajit, he executed. His mind was confused effectively by Akrura and Kritavarma, and with his own evil nature, it didn't take much, in other words, to get him going. He went to kill Satyajit. And how did he do that? He snuck into Satyajit's house at night. And even with all Satyajit's wives present, he butchered Satyajit mercilessly, right in front of all his wives. His wives are screaming and crying, and Shatadanva didn't care. He mercilessly butchered Satyajit, just like someone butchers an animal. Satyabhama was there because since her husband Krishna was away from home, she's staying with her father. That's the Vedic system. That the woman is protected either by the husband, by the father, or by the oldest son. So she was staying with her father because her husband was away in another city. So she gets to see, you know, her father being mercilessly butchered. So she falls on the floor unconscious. So she decides to go to Hastinapur to tell Krishna. Of course, Krishna, being omniscient, already knows. But Satyabhama wanted to go there because she wanted to request Krishna to bring her father back to life. She actually, a technical point is, she didn't have so much affection to her father at all. That's unusual in Vedic culture. Why didn't she have affection for her father? Because she knew he's got a problem with Krishna. And I don't like him. Anyone who's got a problem with Krishna, even if it's my own father, I don't like. But out of duty, she wanted to see, knowing Krishna is all powerful, maybe my husband Krishna can bring him back to life. So she went to Hastinapur And while she was away, before she left, she put Satadrin's body in a vat of oil to preserve it. Because, you know, being a lady, she knows how to be a drama queen. She, I'm saying, you know, in a good way, you know. Drama is part of life, you know. It's, you know, it's dealings, you know. Men have their way of dealing. Ladies know how to make dramas. We're not making any value judgments at all. So, she knew that I'll keep the body of my father in a vat of oil, so when Krishna returns from Hastinapur, he'll see right with his own eyes what Satadri did, and he'll take action. Seeing is believing. It'll be more effective than by speaking. So that way, Satyabhama, who actually is always a drama queen, like for Krishna's pleasure, she went to Hastinapur, and she came and approached Krishna, and she's crying. And why is she crying? Because she wants Krishna to cry too. That's such a bomb. I'm crying, I'm lamenting. Krishna, you cry, you lament. And Krishna did it. He put on a show. He knows how to keep a peaceful home. Krishna's expert. My wife wants me to cry in the bed. Oh, okay. So both Krishna and Balaram are crying. But it was all external, because Krishna and Balaram knew Satyadri never liked us. He has a problem mentality. But we're imitating the ways of human society, and everyone around us is lamenting, so we'll get into it too. To satisfy Satyabhama and just to keep normal social decorum. So he did that. Because Krishna's concerned how to satisfy the general public as much as possible without going overboard. So they returned to Dwarka. Krishna was intent on pursuing justice. Remember, in Dwarka, Krishna is not a cowherd boy, he's a prince. He's a kshatriya, and kshatriyas are meant for upholding law and order. So, they returned to Dwarka, and everyone knew in Dwarka something was going to happen. Krishna is making plans to terminate Satyadri. Even Satyadri, Shatadamba. Even Shatadamba heard about it. It was no secret. As far as Satyabhama's hopes that Krishna would bring her father back to life, Krishna gave her a tidy explanation. He said, look, you know, his life was destined to be short. There's really nothing I can do. In other words, he didn't want to. But he didn't say that to his wife. You know, he packaged the whole thing very appropriately. His life was destined to be short, you understand. So Satyabhama accepted that. Okay, Krishna, can't bring my father back to life because my father was destined to have a short life. Okay. So, Satyabhama, he knew, my time is coming to an end. And he went to Akrura and Kritavarma for shelter. Can't you do something? Krishna is after me. You were the ones who instigated me to kill Satyadri. Now, do something. And what was Akrura and Kritavarma's response? Like, hey, it's your affair. What are you coming to us for? They said, we can't give you any shelter against Krishna. We never do anything against Krishna. Where's devotees? Well, what are you coming to us for? We're not involved with this. You do your own thing. We don't know you. Kritavarma told him, don't you understand? We might have instigated you to kill Satyadri, but we didn't have any hostility toward Krishna. So if you don't want to surrender to Krishna, why should we also act in that way? We are surrendered. We can't mix with you. We have different modus operandi. We have different goals. Sorry, we don't know you. Shatadamba was really in a panic. Now, I've got no shelter. I've got no protection anywhere. Kritavarma also told him that, look what happened to Kamsa. Kamsa had so many powerful chieftains, warrior chieftains at his command, and still Krishna dispatched him. So what about Jarasandha? 17 times Krishna defeated him in battle. Well, what do you want from us? You've got a problem. You don't want to surrender to Krishna. We don't have that problem. We're with Krishna. You meet your own fate. So Shatadamba then went to Akrura. You got to do something. I've heard Krishna's planning to kill me. You're Krishna's devotee. Can't you do something? And Akrura gave him the same kind of response. Don't you know who Krishna is? He bewilders even the creators of the cosmos. They can't understand his plans. They're covered by his maya. Don't you know who Krishna and Balaram are? They're the supreme personalities of Godhead. What do you want me to do? You're out of harmony with them. There's nothing that can be done about your situation. So Shatadamba decided that I've got to get out of here. I've got to leave Dwarka. So he left the Shyamantaka jewel, because you know when he killed Suchajit, of course he took the jewel. He left the Shyamantaka jewel with Akrura, saying, I put this under your care. Now what does it mean when you put something under someone's care? It means you still think it's yours. And that was Shatadamba. Here, Akrura, you're known as so trustworthy in Dwarka. Here's my jewel. Will you please take care of it while I flee? I'll be back to get the jewel. So he did that. He was so extremely possessive. That's the nature of the material energy. It makes you so crazy like that. My jewel. Even though this jewel is causing misfortune right and left because of its possessor's material attitudes. Even though the jewel is meant to give protection, now it's causing the opposite. Even though the jewel is meant to give fortune, now it's bringing the opposite. So Shatadamba, he got a special horse in Dwarka that could run for 800 miles. How many kilometers is that? About 1,300 kilometers. The horse could go that far in one go. So Shatadamba jumped on this horse. But by the time the horse had done its dash of 1,300 kilometers, it died of exhaustion. And so Shatadamba, he dismounted and he began to run on foot. Krishna and Balaram are pursuing him with their chariot. When they saw that Shatadamba got off the horse, which was dying and soon to be dead, they also got off their chariot. Make it fair. Yeah, Kshatriyas, okay. You're off your mount, we'll dismount also. It'll be a fair fight. To a point. Because remember, how fair was Suchajit in killing, how fair was Shatadamba in killing Suchajit? Butchering him in the middle of the night while he's sleeping? So don't expect Krishna to be completely fair in dealing with such a culprit. So Shatadamba's fleeing on foot, and Krishna and Balaram are running after him. This is their leela. They don't have to chase anyone. It just adds adventure. So while Shatadamba's running, Krishna takes out his disc and severs Shatadamba's head. So you might say, well, that's not fair. Kshatriyas are supposed to fight face to face. And actually, according to Kshatriya warrior code, when an enemy is fleeing, you don't pursue the enemy. You just say, oh, he's a coward. But Krishna was determined to finish Shatadamba because Shatadamba had killed a superior. Suchajit was his superior. He was one of the senior personalities, even though he had a materialistic mentality. But from the Vedic point of view, he was a senior personality, regardless of the condition of his mentality, which wasn't proper Vaishnava mentality. So, because Satadanva had did that horrible thing of killing a senior while he's sleeping, Krishna didn't show him the normal battlefield decorum. So while he's running away, Krishna just severed his head. So then, Krishna knew he didn't have the jewel on him, but Krishna had something else in mind. He started searching his body, the body of Satadanva. Where's the jewel? Where's the jewel? Because Krishna's thinking, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains this, that Krishna's thinking that I want to separate from Balaram. I want Balaram to have a reason for going somewhere else. Particularly, I want him to go to nearby Mithila, where there's King Bahulashva, who's a pure devotee. I want Balaram to reciprocate with that great devotee. So I've got to get Balaram going somewhere else. So Krishna pretended, I don't know where the jewel is. I'm searching the body. He went back to Balaram and said, the jewel's not there. What to do? Thinking that Balaram would now conclude, all right, Krishna, you go back to Dwarka and look for the jewel. Maybe I'll do something else. So that's what Krishna had in mind. But Balaram knew, Krishna, you're omniscient. You know where the jewel is. Why are you trying to bewilder me? And actually, Balaram got a bit angry. Why are you putting this trip on me? Anyway, I know I'm supposed to be bewildered. All right, I'll go to Mithila. You go back to Dwarka. In this way, the one absolute truth functions as Krishna and Balaram. Krishna went back to Dwarka, and Balaram went to spend a few years with King Bahulashva, reciprocating with him for his pure devotion. So Krishna was able to return to Dwarka, and what was the first thing he did? He went to his queen, Satyabhama. My dear, I was unable to keep your father alive. But even though your father had a short lifespan, that's the way it was meant to be. Nevertheless, I have killed his killer with my own hand. But Krishna knew how to be dramatic. You know, as a husband, he knew, you know, you gotta make dramas to reciprocate with the dramas that your wife creates. I have killed him with my own hand. That way, you know, such a bomb of, okay, you couldn't bring my father back to life, but you did great anyway. This is all part of human life, you see, and Krishna is imitating human pastimes, Naralila. So, okay. It's not simply that Satyabhama is a drama queen. Krishna knows also how to respond with appropriate dramas. In this way, he's showing, you know, what life is like in the palace and in the home, dramas. So then, he and his wife performed the funeral ceremonies for Satyaji. And meanwhile, Akrura and Kritavarma, what are they thinking? They're afraid. Even though they are devotees of Krishna, they knew we instigated Satadanva. Maybe we're going to get some retribution too. So they fled Dwarka. Akrura went to Varanasi and stayed there with the jewel. So meanwhile, what was happening in Dwarka? Apparently, all kinds of ill omens had manifested. There were climate changes. There were all sorts of mental and physical disturbances. So the people started concluding that because Akur is not here, and his family line has a reputation of being able to quell disturbances wherever they're present, especially his father, Svabalka, was like that. So we are having disturbances in Dwarka because Akur is not present. And then simultaneously, there were rumors that Krishna had driven Akur out of Dwarka because Akur was becoming too powerful. He had the jewel And Krishna was envious of his mounting prestige. So that more rumors, see, the Shyamataka jewel is really a headache. Krishna was envious, he was feeling competition. His luster was threatened by Akura's rising star. So Krishna exiled him, like one political leader exiles a rival. He exiled him to Varanasi. So those rumors were spreading like wildfire. Again, more rumors. Rukmini and Balaram, they didn't believe it. But the rumors were that thick. So you just see the Supreme Personality of God, it has to deal with intricacies. So when Krishna saw the rumors mounting, he decided to request Akura to return. The people had come to him with the problems, their disturbances. It must be because of Akura. Please ask Akura to return. So Krishna said, all right, we'll bring Akura back and that will stop the disturbances. Now, actually, who was causing the disturbances? It was Krishna. He was making it so that there appeared to be natural disturbances in Dwarka so that the people would demand Akura comes back, and that way they would stop accusing Krishna of having exiled him. So Krishna engineered the whole situation, and they came to him. Can you ask Akura to come back? Oh, okay. If we bring him back, there won't be any more natural disturbances. Okay, we'll bring Akura back. So that way, Krishna cleared his name again. So then, Akura comes back, and Krishna speaks to him very consolingly, and at the same time, very mildly chastises him. Akura is a pure devotee. And Krishna told him, I know you're a great devotee. Why do you have something to fear? So you may question, how is it that Akura, and also Kritabharma, but especially Akura, how did they get caught up in all these murder conspiracies and fighting over jewels and getting a little slightly attached to the Shyamataka jewel? Why? Well, the hidden reason is that the gopis in Vrindavan had cursed Akura. You took Krishna away, so we're cursing you to undergo some misfortune. It was external, though. And Krishna told Akura, I know your heart. It's not simply that I am the super soul in your heart. I am the super soul of the super soul in your heart. The super souls are, all of them are my expansions. So I know what's going on. I know you're not Satyajit's enemy. I know you weren't greedy for wealth. You're my greatest devotee. I know your mind. I know even the super soul in your mind. There's no mystery for me. So, what about the jewel? I know you have the jewel, and there's no way to deny it, because the rumors are all around Dwarka that you have a lot of gold every day. That means you're worshiping the jewel. Look. I don't really want the jewel. I just would like to show it to the residents of Dwarka so that the end of all this intrigue and rumor spreading comes. Krishna, and then he really wanted, and Krishna knows how to be dramatic too. He wanted to really impress upon Akura. He said, you know, even my brother Balaram doesn't believe me. So just give me the jewel and I'll show it to everyone. Here it is, okay. Go home and have your milk and cookies. Here's the jewel. So Akura felt a little ashamed, like, Krishna has to speak to me in this way. Yes, true, I'm his devotee, and it's true, I had no sinister motives, but it's also true I became a little attached to the jewel. So he reached behind his cloth and pulls out the jewel and gives it to Krishna. This is in the royal assembly. Krishna takes the jewel, shows everyone, see, okay. And then Krishna says, look, this jewel should be kept by someone who is qualified, who can actually handle the power of this jewel. I think there's no one better than you, Akura. So Krishna gives him back the jewel. You take care of this. This jewel's caused so much havoc, in other words. But you take care of it because you're actually a great sage. And this way, everyone can experience the benefits of the jewel and not all the the downside, which has caused so much problem. Theft, murder, revenge, on and on it went. So, what do you have to say now about the complications of your life? So Krishna's showing how to handle it all in Krishna consciousness. He's untouched by all these situations. He keeps his focus, and we have to learn how to keep our focus on Krishna's service. Despite the intrigues, the dramas, and you heard how Krishna is expert in drama. You gotta be being married to such a Bama. She's the ultimate drama queen. Remember when Krishna from the heavenly planets took a Parijata flower, and you know the flower with the most heavenly fragrance, and he gave it to Rukmini. What happened? What happened with such a Bama? She blew her top. What is this? You've given your other wife a Parijata flower from the heavenly planets. What about me? Now, Rukmini would never do such a thing. She's mild and submissive, but Satyabhama, again, she's the drama queen. And she made a huge drama. Krishna, this is not proper. You gave her, my co-wife, you gave her the Parijata flower. What are you gonna do for me? She hit Krishna up with that line, what have you done for me lately? So Krishna, he pretended to be a henpecked husband. Okay, what have I done for you lately? Watch this. Krishna went back to the heavenly planet and brought down not a Parijata flower, but a whole Parijata tree. Oh. Now Satyabhama had more. So he gave her to Satyabhama the Parijata tree. But then Krishna was watching. Will Rukmini now get angry? But Rukmini didn't get angry. She wasn't stirred in the least. That was the precursor why Krishna decided to try to artificially devise a scene to see anger on Rukmini's face. Because even when Satyabhama surpassed her by getting a whole Parijata tree, Rukmini didn't get angry. And so Krishna noted that. How am I ever going to see her beautiful, angry face? So as I always point out, what husband would dare do these kind of things? It shows you're not the supreme enjoyer. Krishna could do that. Let me enjoy the face of my wife in anger. You wouldn't dare. You married men wouldn't dare do such a thing. But Krishna enjoys everything. Rukmini didn't get angry. I have to do something. Just to see that anger side of her beauty. So, in this way, life with Satyabhama goes on. So just see what Krishna gets from this whole Leela. He gets two beautiful wives, and he gets the jewel too, which he gave away. He didn't care for that. Krishna always comes out on top in every situation. In spite of all the intrigue, the rumors, the defamation, Krishna is simply the supreme enjoyer. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.